If I can just begin the proceedings. Good morning to you all, and welcome to the fifth LSE Gulf Breakfast briefing, of course, on the theme today of climate change and the Gulf countries. I am David Held, Chair of the LSE Kuwait Programme. We have a very extensive programme on the Gulf countries at the LSE, funded by the Kuwait Foundation for the Advancement of Sciences. We run a series of public seminars, a series of public lectures, major conferences, and a series of research papers which have come out on the Gulf on a very regular basis. One of our speakers has just published this research paper on energy sustainability policies in the Gulf countries. It's available outside, but you would find on our website most of these papers, a lot of the papers that are already published on the website. And I should point out that today's talks will be on the website quite shortly after they are given. The talks will be recorded. Your questions and the discussions will not. Chatham House rules apply. So let me briefly welcome the speakers, Professor Sir David King and Professor Giacomo Luciani, and say something just briefly about you, about both of you. Professor Sir David King is director of the Smith School of Enterprise and the Environment at Oxford, and a leader of the Surface Science Group at Cambridge. Previously, he was, of course, the UK's chief scientific advisor for 7 years, 2000 to 2007, during which, among other things, he warned governments worldwide about the dangers of climate change. Before that, he was head of Cambridge University's chemistry department and master of Downing College. Professor Giacomo Luciani is senior advisor at the Gulf Research Center in Dubai and director of the Gulf Research Center Foundation in Geneva. Since 1997, he's been a professorial lecturer of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University Bologna Center and has taught at the University of Lausanne, at the Graduate Institute of International Development Studies in Geneva, and at Sciences Po. He has published widely on political economy of the Gulf states and on issues of oil and transparency, as well as on Euro-Gulf relations. David King will talk about the broad issues of climate change, I think, to begin with, for 10 to 15 minutes, and our second speaker will focus particularly on Gulf-related aspects. So good morning to you all. We start now, finish at 9. The floor is yours, David.
Thank you very much, David. Very pleased to be here. What I'm going to do is just set the scene rather broadly by telling you what the current state of the science of climate change is and why this is an imperative for all nations to be concerned about. When I first joined government and began talking about climate change back in 2000, there was some remarkable paleoclimatology data on the climate history of the planet going about 300,000 years back. The interest in climate change has stimulated an enormous amount of scientific work in this area, and we can now look back hundreds of millions of years. The data going back to 850,000 years is all very largely obtained from ice cores taken in the Antarctic. The longest ice core analyzed is 3 kilometers long, and if you imagine the bottom of the ice core, you're looking at compacted ice from a snowfall that fell 850,000 years ago, and the top of the ice core is last year's snowfall, and captured into the ice are bubbles of air, which means you've sampled the atmosphere from that time back. So we have, from the oxygen isotope ratio in the water, in the ice, and from the bubbles of air, we have a record of the state of the planet's atmosphere going back a long time and its temperature. The ocean sedimentologists then come into the act, and they find that they can easily go back 850,000 years, and their data matches the data from ice cores very accurately, but they can go back much further, 200 million years. So what I'm now going to show you is I would have thought beyond our wildest dreams to see such remarkable data back in the year 2000. This is 60 million years of the globe's history. This is the present day here, going back in time. And we see that about 50 million years ago, this is temperature on this axis. The planet went through a temperature maximum. This is Eocene-Pliocene transition, for those of you interested in these times. Temperature about 12 degrees centigrade higher than the pre-industrial temperature of the planet. So it was a hot planet. There was no ice on any land. And Antarctica at this point was a subtropical forest. Large mammals are found when you dig down into the below the ice and the remnants of that forest. Now, it took about 50 million years, this is a non-linear scale here, 50 million years for the planet to cool down to the sort of temperatures that we're familiar with. These oscillations here, it's not noise in the data, indicate that the temperature of the planet becomes bistable, and a bistable system is a part of that chaos theory that is being developed. So this bistability means that the temperature is exists between two bands. It's quite a narrow range, but the two bands indicate that the planet is either rather cold, ice age, or rather warm. We call them a warm period, or the interglacial period. So just let's expand this last bit here, and this is the scale shown below. And we have an ice age, warm period, and we see immediately that these warm periods are truly interglacial in that they're very short. So we have warm period, warm period, warm period. And we come into the present warm period, beginning 18,000 years ago out of that ice age. We come there 12,000 years ago. And we have the longest warm period on record. This very long warm period is the period, of course, of our civilization, essentially. One of the questions is, what is happening? Why is there such a long warm period here? And there are ideas around this being the first Anthropocene, that it's our activity that was already affecting the climate at that point. We developed in the region, initially one suspects around Mesopotamia, we developed farming practices, and in doing that we took out trees. Trees pump carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and so that process itself has given rise to a small carbon dioxide rise. So what I'm showing here in yellow is the carbon dioxide levels from these ice cores, and you see a very good correlation between carbon dioxide levels and the temperature of the planet. Anyone who saw the Channel 4 documentary will immediately see that they doctored their graphs in order to claim that there wasn't a relationship. You can superimpose them and you get a pretty good relationship. So what we see is warm period, carbon dioxide levels about 270 parts per million, and ice age about 200 parts per million. Carbon dioxide kept within very narrow limits by the co-evolution of ourselves, mammals giving out carbon dioxide, plants absorbing carbon dioxide, and the geological system, or co-evolving to keep that within very narrow limits. Here, the most important lesson is mankind, hominids begin to appear at about this point. Mankind develops somewhere around here. We're a recent evolutionary species, of course. But the atmosphere, the planet, delivers an ecosystem that is perfectly suited to our requirements because we co-evolved with it. And now we are in danger of damaging that ecosystem and turning it into something that we actually are not suited for. So the point about this is not just climate change, but the entire ecosystem has been mismanaged and will continue to be mismanaged unless we use our knowledge that we have developed over time to manage our affairs and our environmental affairs in particular. So this climb here, you could say, is the beginning of agricultural practices. This climb here in carbon dioxide up to 389 parts per million now is the post-industrial impact. So this is us discovering that instead of burning wood to get the energy that we needed, wood can be restored by growing the next tree, we were burning fossil fuels and burning them as fast as we could. So all of this rise, and there's no argument about this, is simply our use of fossil fuels. All of the discussion in the scientific community is not about, is climate change anthropogenic? Is it mankind doing it? We know that. The question is, what is the actual impact of this rise going to be? If you ask that question simply in terms of paleoclimatology, you could ask the question, how far back in time have we gone already? And the answer is about this point here. And there's good news, because we have already turned off the next ice age, and I think that's very good news, but we've overshot already. If you asked me how much we would need to turn off the next ice age, I would have said 300 parts per million was plenty, and we're already at 390. Can we, if we keep burning fossil fuels, get all the way back up here? I'm afraid the answer is almost certainly yes. So if we have no global rules about the use of fossil fuels, we can return the planet to this state. And let me remind you, 12 degrees centigrade higher than the pre-industrial temperature is pretty hot. So the region between the tropics is unbearable. The changes in the weather patterns already are very significant, and so far we've only had a 0.75 degrees centigrade temperature rise. So the impact across the world would be enormous, and this is the reason why Copenhagen is so vital and necessary. So I think from that you will see that I believe that we human beings, if we want to leave the planet in a state that our grandchildren can operate satisfactorily, have to act, and we have to act now. The question is whether we have the nous, the social and political nous, to respond to what the scientific community is saying, and that's a question I leave for you and others to discuss. This gives a very simple idea of the imperatives that we're talking about. It's a graph drawn showing the emissions in billions of tons of carbon dioxide per annum from the developed world in looks like mustard, and from the developing countries in pink. This is drawn in this way because of the original Kyoto process dividing the world into Annex 1 and non-Annex 1. So in effect, this is the Annex 1 countries here. And emissions rising year on year on the business as usual scenario if we continue basing our economies on fossil fuel. If we defossilize our economies, then it's possible that here we are, 2010, that we could turn around and stabilize most optimally at 450 parts per million. Now, why would one want to do that? If you take the best state of science today at 450 parts per million, the temperature rise on the planet, by the time it has equilibrated, there's about 30 years of inertia in the planet's system. By the time it's equilibrated, the temperature rise is estimated to be 2.2 degrees centigrade is the peak on the probability distribution function. There's a 5% probability the temperature rise will only be 1.4 degrees centigrade, but there's a 20% probability that the temperature rise will be greater than 3.7 degrees centigrade. So I'm afraid the best that science can do is give you probabilities on what the temperature rise will be at a given stabilization level. 550 parts per million, and already the peak in the probability function is looking, it's approaching 3 degrees centigrade. 3.7 degrees centigrade, I picked that out, 20% probability. So we've only got an 80% chance, even on this most optimistic curve, of keeping the temperature, 80% chance of keeping the global temperature rise below 3.7 degrees centigrade. 3.7 degrees centigrade, let me assure you, would be a very uncomfortable situation for every state in the world. If we take, for example, a state that is already highly vulnerable, India, the Indian economy is totally dependent on the monsoon. So the people of India have not only adapted to the monsoon, they've entirely adapted their economy to the monsoon. If the monsoon is 10% low one year, massive crop failure, depend on rice. If it's 10% high one year, higher than average, massive flooding, loss of life. They depend critically on that monsoon being reproducible within these narrow limits. There's no question monsoons are a very sensitive weather system, and as the temperature rises, we're going to see very big changes in these weather systems. The state of Victoria in Australia used to be a vegetable garden for Australia. It's now suffered successive years of drought. In that state, and you'll see why I'm mentioning this before I finish, in that state, the state government is now producing desalinated water, using coal to fire up the desalinated water to produce one-third of the freshwater supply for the citizens and villages and towns of the state of Victoria. So Melbourne and all those cities being supplied now by desalination plants. Very energy intensive process. The desalination is therefore exacerbating the problem that they're trying to deal with by desalination. We've got an awful negative feedback loop on that process. And I mention this in relation to the Gulf States. The Gulf States not only are susceptible to these large temperature rises, but the loss of water is a very big issue. And so managing that problem with desalination is a technological solution, but what we need to recall is that wherever we need desalination, there's an awful lot of solar energy around. So we need to begin to introduce regulatory systems which acknowledge that we must avoid totally the use of fossil fuels for energy production, particularly when we have massive supplies of solar energy. There's 10,000 times as much solar energy reaching the Earth's surface as we would need for all of our energy requirements if we converted it efficiently into electricity, heat, and desalinated water. So as we move forward, the need to stay on this curve, the need to defossilize our economies, and I use that word carefully, because let me express the requirement. Today we're emitting about 30 billion tons of carbon dioxide per annum. That's where we are on this curve. If we go to mid-century, we need to bring that down to 18 billion tons of carbon dioxide per annum. We expect to be 9 billion people on the planet by mid-century. That means divide 18 by 9 and you have 2 tons per person per annum as your allocation. In Britain today, we're using just over 10 tons per person per annum. We need to bring it down to 2, which is why the government's aspiration is an 80% reduction in emissions by mid-century. In America, that figure is 22, and in the Gulf States, that figure is considerably higher than in the United States. What we need to do is move our economies into a situation of 80% reduction, and that is the biggest challenge we face, and at the same time, for the private sector, the biggest opportunity that we face as we move forward in time. Let me just say, in moving to Oxford as I left government, I've set up this curious beast in an ancient university, the Smith School. We are all about finding solutions to these problems. So we're bringing the academic knowledge-based community in an interdisciplinary way together into our hub with governments from around the world and working with the private sector to take marketplace solutions, low-carbon marketplace solutions into the marketplace. This is also a matter of talking to the private sector about shifting their business from high carbon to low carbon in order to survive. The model for non-survival is, I would suggest, General Motors. Producing the Humvee was the last phase of a dying beast. The alternative, of course, is Toyota producing the Prius hybrid, which became the symbol of people who cared a little bit about the environment. So what we see is models of private sector companies' survival, but more than that, we see opportunities. There's massive opportunities in the challenges faced for scientists, technologists, engineers working in the private sector to take these solutions through to the marketplace. If your company gets these solutions early on, you're going to be putting the competition out of business. So that's really what we're about. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I will have many fewer things to say than Professor King, and especially I don't have the advantage of going back in past eras studying the ice cap. How does this affect the Gulf countries, and what are the preoccupations of the Gulf countries with respect to the discussions on climate change? Well, I think it's very obvious how the Gulf countries may feel threatened by any limitations on the use of fossil fuels. That's a very superficial point of view. It's obvious that as the major producers of the leading fossil fuel, which is oil, they would be worried about any decision that makes it less competitive and reduces its market. That said, I think it should be also said that scenarios that we had until 4 or 5 years ago about future consumption of oil, scenarios that were based on business as usual assumptions and were showing Saudi Arabia, for example, producing 20, 25 million barrels per day by 2025 or 2030, those were never in the wishes of the governments of the region, were never perceived as being in their best interest. So, a reduction, scenarios that we see today based on 450 ppms are, in a sense, much closer to what is the declared policy and the declared strategy of the oil-producing countries, a strategy which is based on having oil last for a long period of time, having production peak and stabilize on a plateau that they will be able to sustain for 50 years. So that's quite different from the approach of international oil companies, which would normally run down an oil field much more quickly than that. That said, it is clear that why this discussion is a threat for the oil-producing countries. But is it not also an opportunity? I believe it is, in fact, a huge opportunity for the development of the Gulf countries. Why is that? The Gulf countries are, in fact, extremely well-positioned in order to take advantage of what needs to be done, of the kind of transformation that we need in order to resist climate change. First of all, a simple and yet probably the number one technology that we need to use in this context, which is carbon capture and sequestration, is easier, is cheaper, easier in the Gulf countries than in almost any other part of the world. Not absolutely any other part of the world, but it certainly is one of the locations in which this is easiest. Why? Because we have the storage fields. One can pump the carbon dioxide back into oil and gas, depleted oil and gas fields, and has the added benefit of facilitating the production of the oil, especially the heavier tails of the oil in those fields. So it is a method for enhanced oil recovery, well established in that respect. Because the pattern of industrialization in the Gulf countries is based on high energy intensive industry. We are talking about massive power generation, refining, petrochemicals, all the industries that are large emitters of CO2. And therefore, we have more of an opportunity for large-scale capture. And because these industries are typically concentrated in industrial cities, in large industrial clusters, which again facilitates the task of capturing and gathering for sequestration rather than what the kind of industrial pattern that we have in Europe. So the implementation of carbon capture and sequestration is one reason why I believe the Gulf countries are well positioned and could consider a shift towards more climate-friendly policies an opportunity rather than a threat. Number two reason is because the Gulf countries, I believe, are very well positioned to massively engage in developing nuclear energy. Civilian nuclear energy is a must I am one who does not believe that we can function on the basis of wind, sun, and renewables only. And we need to look for countries and situations in which the development of nuclear energy is feasible at a fast pace. And the Gulf countries offer these opportunities because their governments are, if you wish, authoritarian or, you know, have a strong central decision-making power, differently from governments in Europe where you need to negotiate with each municipality, because there is much less competition on the use of land, because nuclear energy is capital intensive, and the Gulf countries have the finance to engage in that, and finally, because they have a habit of relying on international expertise. And there is no strong nationalist undercurrent which may cause problems in terms of developing the know-how and you know, making sure that the technology is not misused for other purposes. So I think when we look around, there are few places better suited than the Gulf countries for a massive thrust towards utilizing nuclear energy. Then, of course, there is solar. That is very obvious. And the utilization of solar energy will attract, is attracting increasing attention, although I believe because of the nature of the technology, which necessitates many smaller projects rather than few very large projects, the kind of know-how, managerial know-how, and decision-making process in the Gulf will probably find it more difficult to pursue solar energy in a short span of time. But surely it will come. Finally, I think they also have they might also have an opportunity in developing some of the new biomass, especially when I hear about algae and cultivations of crops that require saline environments. It's obvious that this is where one of the places in the world, in the globe, that may develop such cultivations. So I think there is a huge opportunity for the Gulf countries in terms of diversifying their economies. And having said that, it is clear that at the global level, the need for containing emissions, the need to get it down, to not go beyond 450 parts per million, will entail an economic burden. There is a burden to be shared. And the issue is, how is this going to be shared? So when you hear a certain cautions or even, you know, at times antagonistic attitude on the part of the Gulf countries concerning negotiations underway in preparation for Copenhagen, I think this is justified and must be understood in the context of the great uncertainty on how the burden will be shared. It's obvious that it all depends on the kind of rules that we will adopt. There may be rules that end up attributing too much of the burden on the Gulf countries, and there is going to be a normal tendency in between all governments to simply shift the burden on my neighbors or whomever is not equipped to negotiate adroitly and avoid being put in a corner. This fear, this anxiety is justified because, after all, we come and we are in a situation in which oil has been systematically discriminated against. Oil is, as a source of energy, is heavily taxed, as we all know, to the final consumer. And so governments have been ready to intervene and change and influence relative prices with fiscal tools, with administrative tools, facilitating or supporting certain solutions rather than others. So when we hear discussions about climate change, there is always a certain undertone of making ourselves independent of oil imports, as if these two things were the same. Now, they are not necessarily the same. And I don't think it is acceptable from the point of view of the Gulf countries that they should be treated together. I hear a lot about clean coal. Clean coal is what? It's coal with carbon capture and sequestration. But then why don't we speak of clean oil and clean gas in the same fashion? I mean, carbon capture and sequestration you can do with any fossil fuel. So I think there is an element of, ideology or propaganda or populism which is underlying certain approaches. We have a record of government interfering with relative prices and decision making on the part of the consumer, which has negative consequences in the end, even for the climate. A case in point is the treatment of diesel versus gasoline in the European market. I don't have time to go in depth in this, but we have made the policy of favoring diesel and diesel powered cars for years because the same car, if it is powered by a diesel engine, will emit less CO2 and will consume less fuel than a gasoline powered car. However, overall, in the aggregate, in the European context, this is leading to an excess, to an imbalance in between consumption of diesel and consumption of gasoline. And the consequence is that we need to import more oil and refine more oil in order to get the diesel that we need. And we don't know what to do with the gasoline, so we sell it abroad. And overall, this translates into increase the CO2 emissions in Europe rather than decrease, in addition to translating into a dependency on imports of diesel from Russia specifically, which I don't see discussed when people worry about imports of gas, for example. So is it wise to subsidize diesel over gasoline necessarily? Has it been wise for years and years to skew the tables in such a way that consumers have been induced to buy diesel power cars? I have doubts. And so we have plenty of examples of governments interfering with this decision making. If we go down the road of a transparent, uniform carbon tax, I think the Gulf countries will have no objection to that, because in the end, I think they can play the game in a world in which there is a uniform carbon tax, the Gulf countries will be competitive and will be able to develop and industrialize, which is what they want. But if we go down the road of complicated and not uniform and not transparent systems to approach the issue of reducing emissions, then I think the Gulf countries are well justified to be skeptical or at least very cautious in jumping on board. So it's a matter of exactly how we will decide to tackle the issue. I think in terms of awareness, the leadership, the political leadership, the technical and scientific leadership in these countries is fully aware of the issue, and this is not a question of denying that there is a problem. I think the awareness is there, and steps are being taken and investment is being made to address the issue. But at the international level, we need to find solutions that are acceptable to all and that attribute the burden in an acceptable way, and especially do not translate into undue forms of protectionism, crypto-protectionism, justified on the basis of climate change requirements. Thank you.